Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, Adam Kokresh joins Gary Franchi to discuss what life is like as a soldier in modern war, his activism in favor of gun rights, including his civil disobedience in Washington that led to his arrest, and how he was received by his new audience behind bars.
Could the wars in the Middle East be turning U.S. soldiers against the government for whom they once fought? After more than a dozen years of American military involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, a growing number of veterans are beginning to take a strong stand against federal policies. One of the best known of these soldiers is Adam Kokresh. He joined the group Iraq Veterans Against the War in 2007, and that same year he was arrested for protesting the war outside the Hart Senate Office Building. A decorated veteran of the war in Iraq, he was arrested for loading a shotgun in front of the White House just last year. He pleaded guilty to firearms charges and was sentenced to 2 years of probation. Supporters who believed the case would go to trial were advocating for his case to be nullified by the jury. Prosecutors hope to charge the activist with attempting to smuggle a cell phone into his cell. And today, many people see him as a symbol of resistance to government intrusion in personal liberties. Kokresh is our guest on the show today. He's here to talk to us about what life is like as a modern soldier of war. We'll also discuss his activism in favor of gun rights, including his civil disobedience in Washington that led to his arrest. Allegations Edward Snowden was assisted by the Russian intelligence agency will also be a topic of conversation, along with some of his thoughts about the future of American government. Welcome back to the program, Adam.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Gary, and I really appreciate the introduction, but I do have to point out the sentence did include time served, which was 4 months, including 2 months in solitary confinement. It wasn't as easy as you make it sound, but it was amazing to reach so many people, millions really, given the extensive TV coverage that we got with the message that self-defense is a civil right.
Well, let's talk about that. Here's a clip of you loading the shotgun in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. This is what stirred the whole incident that led to your arrest. Let's take a look.
We will not be silent. We will not obey. We will not allow our government to destroy our humanity. We are the final American revolution. See you next Independence Day.
Okay, so what made you decide to take the action to go and load a shotgun in front of the White House? And of course, this is what led to the arrest. What was the decision behind it?
Well, all of my activism is geared towards inspiring self-government and assertion of self-ownership, that we as free, beautiful, independent human beings own ourselves, and we're not slaves to anybody, let alone government that pretends to represent some collective. And this came out of the idea for an armed march on D.C., which I canceled after I was arrested in Philadelphia and disappeared for a week after being set up on false felony charges there for assaulting a federal officer. I was very lucky in how that played out. I played hardball, refused to cooperate for an entire week, and I refused to accept the terms of their release, which would have included no firearms, and they dropped the charges after a week in jail there. So that was a really, really fun play. But when the government was able to basically just get away with disappearing me for a week, and I didn't feel like I had the organization or the structure to pull off this armed march properly, I really felt like it was in the best interest of safety to cancel it. So I did that, but I wanted to live up to, you know, the expectation that I had set for myself, which was that this was a worthwhile act of civil disobedience. So that's what I did. And I think it's very important that people assert that. And from, you know, the thousands of letters I got while I was in jail, it seems like it had a very positive effect on inspiring a lot of resistance. And, you know, the importance of the Second Amendment, but words on paper don't protect your rights. People standing up and asserting their rights is the only thing that's going to actually have any impact on whether or not your rights are respected. So if more people were willing to do that and you know, stand up when they saw the opportunity, well, we wouldn't be in the problem that we're in today, as you know, where we're suffering economically as a country, where we're dealing with the police state, where we still see an incredible transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich. And it's about fundamental human rights. And when we stand up for those, it's always a great victory. And, you know, I'm really glad with how this played out. But I did underestimate the cost to myself personally in terms of the raid and the jail time. But, you know, as you know, the worst part of what I experienced really was not as much from the government as it was from the people who betrayed me while I was in jail.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because when the SWAT team raided your home, you had people working with you because you work out of your home and you do your Adam versus the Man production out of that residence. And there were allegations that the police had actually planted contraband in your home. What's your take on that whole allegation?
Well, we were forced to sit handcuffed on the floor for 5 hours while they ransacked my home, including my girlfriend at the time. She had been visiting and was on her period in the shower and was pulled out and forced to sit in her own blood for hours before she was allowed to do anything about it. And they turned the house inside out. I was roughed up and sitting on the floor in the kitchen in my home for 5 hours. And, you know, I don't really know what all transpired because I didn't see all of it. But when we were together, we all saw at the same time that there were full paper bags that were evidence bags that were being brought into the house. Now, how that plays out for my charges in Virginia, you know, it remains to be seen. It's an extremely weak case there. But I believe it was a setup really just to give the police an excuse to detain me so that they could take me into custody in Washington, D.C., which is what happened. But while I was in jail, someone who worked for me, Daryl Young, stole my legal defense fund. And there were other people who contributed to this, Ed Skitz and our Ed Yealy, his alias is Skitz as a last name, and Liz Delcano, who also goes by Dish or Zish or Delish as aliases online. And together they stole contributions that came in for my legal defense fund. They lied to the public in my name. They lied to me while I was in jail. And it seems like the strategy was to keep me in jail so that they could keep living off of my business. So while that was going on, I was in jail trying to figure out, you know, how to communicate with supporters, how to communicate with my family. And, you know, they were making that extremely difficult for me. But I figured out what was going on. And I was fortunate that my father and my friend Jeffrey Phillips were able to step in and really help salvage my situation. But when I got out of jail, you know, I didn't come home to a mess. I was homeless. And I'd been evicted because we had trusted Daryl to pay the rent, which he didn't do. And I was about to be taken to court and sued for $24,000 for damages that were incurred on the house while I was gone. So, you know, that's, you know, my personal possessions were supposed to go into a storage unit. Instead, I had a tangled mess of the remainder of my life to go through. It took me 3 days just to sort it out and realize how much was missing. But, you know, I also had about $3,000 worth of silver that was missing. Obviously, it was the police that stole my firearms. But, you know, we have some kind of accounting for that. The silver's gone. I had some family heirlooms, some irreplaceable furniture, stuff from Iraq. I mean, I had a tapestry and a rug. I had shrapnel from an ID that killed a fellow Marine that I had there that is missing. Really about, you know, 2/3 of my personal possessions were gone. And, you know, now I've just been putting my life back together one piece at a time. Being sentenced to time served on Friday was a big relief, and I'm looking forward to launching AVTM 4.0 from Los Angeles as soon as I'm able to get set up there. But right now, actually, we had to delay this interview just by a few minutes, you know, to get so that I could make some calls for my probation officer. And I'm dealing with that, but it looks like we're going to be coming back stronger and better than ever. And, you know, I've learned some lessons the hard way. But I've learned a lot of really valuable lessons, and I'm really ready to come back.
Well, let's talk about that. Hindsight is always 20/20. Looking back, would you have done anything differently?
Oh yeah, of course. You know, but I don't really have time for regrets. I'm moving on, and you know, I've written a book that I started writing when I was in jail. That's going to be a really incredible production that I'm looking forward to getting published and released on Independence Day. And you know, I'm raising the funds now to apply these lessons and to you know, I mean, it kind of hurts to admit it, but the entire Adam versus the Man production was at about half its potential because of poor organization and lack of consistent production values. And that was my fault. And, you know, I take full responsibility for that. And my business plan was, you know, written by a former Marine who didn't have any experience with this. And I could have done a much better job. And now, you know, part of it is just from talking to guys in jail.
Let's talk about that, because you certainly have a following of people through your YouTube channel and through the activism that you do. When you went to jail, when you went to prison, you now have a new audience. And how was your message received, if it was received? I know you were in solitary confinement for a time.
Well, even in solitary, well, the worst part was when I was in solitary in Virginia, and there were only two guys that I could speak to the entire time through the walls. But when I got to Solitary in D.C., we at least had a hallway where you could talk to guys across the hall and, you know, next to you. And so there was always a vibrant conversation. And I definitely have had some really powerful interactions with people. There were a lot of guards there who were very supportive. They all get that gun control is a racket. They all support my cause. I never heard a negative word from any one of the guards. A couple of them were fans before this incident even. And when I got to the general population in D.C. jail, it was at the private jail, which is like right next door and parallel in operation with the government run jail. The private jail is called the CTF. That's Correctional Treatment Facility, where I was corrected, treated, and facilitated, not in the least. But it was I was greeted by inmates in the general population there who came up to me and were like, dude, we saw you on TV. Love your show. You know, love what you do. You're amazing. And it was like, you know, it made it pretty easy for me. I lost 15 pounds in the first 3 weeks I was in jail, and then going to general population, I had inmates bringing me food, and, you know, I gained it all back by the time I got out. But I took it as a great challenge and an outreach opportunity, and got to talk to a lot of people, and they were all very receptive. And, you know, you get the one cynical guy maybe who says, oh yeah, I love gun control because it means that all my victims are disarmed. But, you know, everybody else gets it. And even the guy who might make that point, you know, understands that that's a pretty crappy way of addressing the issue, and understands that.
Well, let's talk about the issue of gun rights. What are some of the ways that you believe gun rights are in danger in the United States?
Well, I think it's just obvious all the way around, you know, and it's because the thing about gun rights and gun control, you know, it's not like, you know, a lot of people make the comparison to Hitler or Mussolini or Mao, and that, you know, oh yeah, totalitarians agree gun control works, and that they disarmed the Jews before the Holocaust. And, you know, there are some very apt comparisons there, but there's a very important difference in gun control in America today, and that is that it is generally supported by the people, and that's what's so scary about it. And I understand that the government isn't a perfect representation of the people, don't get me wrong, but that people don't trust each other, that they would rather, you know, gun control means that government gets to have all the guns, not that there's gun control, because government is totally out of control and government sends guns into Mexico and cops shoot innocent people all the time. So it's about having a monopoly on violence in the hands of government. And the idea that the American people have been conditioned now, not speaking we're all Americans, but that a critical mass of Americans have been conditioned to be afraid of their fellow citizens and trust the government is a really scary point. But that also means that our work in fighting for these fundamental human rights is in reaching out to our fellow Americans and changing the paradigm.
Adam, let's talk about the whistleblowers now. The Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, Bradley Manning, Edward Snowden. Do you believe that the information that they are releasing to the public is criminal, or are they actually protecting American liberty?
Well, what they're doing is exposing the crimes of the American government. So in a way, it's not, you know, an either or question in terms of are they protecting American liberty. I mean, they're protecting the freedom of everyone to know what governments are doing. And, that, you know, that's really everyone throughout the world that's affected by these policies. If anything, we as citizens of the empire here in the United States need to have a much better worldview to understand that we are the well-kept house slaves, if you will. And people in the rest of the world are the ones that really suffer from American government imperialism. And maybe you don't like that term, but it's a pretty apt description when you really understand what's going on. And for me, having served in the Marines and been in Fallujah in 2004, yeah. And you know, seeing what's going on in Iraq right now, seeing the puppet government with all of its problems, they're calling for more government support, seeing the influence of the American government all around the world, you'd be really hard-pressed at this point to deny that what the American government has become is an empire.
Well, Adam, you just mentioned you were in Fallujah, and just recently, Fallujah fell to al-Qaeda forces. What are your thoughts on that, being there, that you were on the ground when America took Fallujah, if you will, and now it's fallen?
Well,
is the war on terror lost?
I think you're playing into the status language right there, sir. When you say that Fallujah has fallen, perhaps Fallujah has risen and, you know, been, you know, liberated from the control of a central government. Perhaps the forces that are there now, and I'm not endorsing al-Qaeda by any stretch of the imagination, but perhaps they're better supported by the people, and that's why they've been able to do what they've done. And it's really important that we get past this idea of thinking as, governments, as the representatives of the people or stability, that Fallujah has fallen. And the war on terror is not, it's like the war on drugs. It's a metaphor, and it's a propaganda tool that's an excuse for specific policies that rip you off, that are part of controlling the people of the world and transferring wealth from the poor to the rich. So will the war on terror ever be won? It'll be won when the people reject it and don't let governments get away with anything in the name of the global war on terror.
A really interesting perspective there, Adam. Now let's talk about the NSA and their recent quest. Revelations are coming out. They're intercepting text messages as well, not just collecting metadata, as was also revealed. What is your take on the NSA's driving quest to store and retrieve and archive private information, private data from Americans?
Well, I hate to say I told you so, but in a way, this is kind of vindicating, because I think back to 2007 when I first got started as an activist with Iraq Veterans Against the War. And, even carrying a cell phone, we used to say, all right, hey, time to have a conversation. And, you leave the phones in the car and you go walk out somewhere where you don't have any electronic devices around. And people back then were like, "Wow, that's crazy. The government's never going to do that. You'll never have that kind of intrusion." And here we are. And now everybody kind of takes it for granted that you can't have a private conversation over any kind of electronic transfer, on any kind of network in America. So it really is predictable, but it also makes me pause and really think about where we are historically as a country, because I'd like to think in the larger scope of human history, we're at the high tide of government, that this is as bad as it's going to get. And if anything, we've seen this pattern play out before in East Germany and in other intense surveillance states. And when a government is at the point of desperation, where they are resorting to these violations of privacy in order to keep people afraid and control the population, that kind of starts the clock on the end of that particular government. And that's a very exciting possibility, because the way that we're going to move out of statism into a free society is by localization, one way or another. If we don't pay attention to these issues, there's going to be a collapse, and we can hope that the government doesn't, spares us in its violent death throes as it clings to power. But I'm much more optimistic, and I think that we can make this a peaceful, smooth transition by facing up to these issues and dissolving governments from the top down, which is why I'm running for president in 2020 on the platform of an orderly dissolution of the federal government. If we don't take charge of the situation and do it that way, the easy way, we're going to be doing things the hard way. And I think the NSA, where it is today, and the fact that all of this is coming out, and the fact that the government is completely recalcitrant. Of course, Obama has decided to defend the NSA and we're going to have these checks on it. And it's obviously all lip service, but that they think they can continue to get away with this means that we are coming to at least the beginning of the end. And it's really just a matter of how this unwinds.
One of the questions I've been asking a lot of our guests lately is, what is the straw? What is the straw that breaks the camel's back of the American people? When are they going to say enough is enough, given all of the revelations that we've seen just in the past year? I'm not going to go back further than that. But what's it going to be before the American people say, we're not going to take this anymore?
Well, I'll quote one of my least favorite former Marines, Mr. Carville, James Carville, who said, "It's the economy, stupid." And the reason that's such an important idea, for politics is that human beings are pragmatic creatures. We don't care about ideology if we can't feed our families. And as long as we are well-kept slaves in America, there's not going to be a straw. And, a lot of people look at, for example, the exponential printing of money under the Federal Reserve System and go, well, that's obviously unsustainable. We're going to hit runaway inflation. Well, not necessarily, because what that represents is a ripoff of, the poor and working class. And as long as productivity is going up exponentially, the ripoff can go off exponentially, because quality of life will still continue to improve on a lower curve or on a linear basis. And the average person will just be like, well, I'm happy to go along to get along. What's really changing is an evolution of thought, a paradigm shift in which people realize that they're better off with self-government. They're going to realize that government is a racket. I don't see the collapse coming because of, you know, something that government does as much as an inevitable empowerment of the people. And that's why I'm hopeful that a peaceful transition will come before a collapse. So
Adam,
I see internet, I see Bitcoin and not necessarily Bitcoin, but cryptocurrencies and, you know, the advantage of smart technology and cell phones that are going into our contact lenses and 3D printing and all this, you know, government is going to be rendered obsolete.
And that's what I want to ask you. Given the rise of technology and the ability for individuals to connect across the world, are governments becoming obsolete in the matter of being able to, quote unquote, rule the people?
Absolutely. And it's, you know, in a sense that people do believe, I mean, statism is the current paradigm. People believe that government is necessary. At least a critical mass of people believe that. And it's for us as libertarians who believe in real freedom, who understand that being governed is incompatible with self-government and self-ownership, to show people the way. And when they're empowered enough to put that into practice, then they're going to combine that with all of these technological advances that actually do render government obsolete. But government is going to be obsolete in the long term, inevitably, because it's based on coercion. I mean, fundamentally, a government is a monopoly on the initiation of force in a specific territory. It is an opinion that, you know, with a gun. It is everything it does is backed up by force or the threat of force or a lie. So that is what is becoming obsolete when humans realize, as a species globally, that voluntary cooperative relationships are always superior to violent coercive relationships. And that's what's going to make government obsolete. When people realize that and demand that. But also, we see parallel to that, laying the groundwork, all of these technological and economic advances that are proof of concept for people. And one of the things that I like to point out is that exponential growth curve of human productivity that is driven by technology. And now we see it very clear with computing power as an exponential growth curve. How are you going to convince people that the welfare state is necessary when you can work for a year and support your family for the rest of your life? How are you going to convince troops to go invade a country by dehumanizing the enemy like they did with us when you can get on Skype and connect to people all over the world? You know, how are they going to convince cops that gun control, that taking people like me to jail is in their best interest when they've realized that this protection racket is just that? And that's the paradigm shift that's happening when that empowerment combines with an understanding of government. And really, that gets back to the book that I've written and the activism that I've dedicated to myself for, that I'm so grateful that people like you are a part of, you know, as an independent media producer, raising awareness, getting this message out on television. I mean, it's really essential. And it's a beautiful opportunity to be alive today and to be conscientious of this. And then to say, I'm going to dedicate my life to this and see yourself as part of this evolutionary process.
Adam, this is the last question now. What can the American people do to counter wrongdoing by federal agencies if they find themselves to be a victim?
Wow, I mean, that's a huge question. There's so much that you can do when you see wrong around you. And really, I think at this point, we can't fight inch by inch anymore. Because you fight inch by inch and the politicians will pat you on the head and say, oh, good little citizen, way to use the democratic process, while they take a mile behind your back and laugh at you while they're doing it. That's why this paradigm shift is so much more important than fighting law by law or election by election. We really need to take charge and see the bigger picture and wake people up. So there are a lot of things that you can do to fight locally or to fight individual laws. And that's great when you can actually lessen the effects of government, when you can lessen the coercion and violence in your life or in your community. But just as important is, you know, living differently, living by these values, practicing agorism, that is conducting your economic affairs outside of the purview of government, building the structures, you know, owning guns and getting to know your neighbors is so important, being self-sustaining, all of these things. But ultimately, it's going to come down to changing the paradigm and society deciding, when we get to that critical point, that tipping point or that critical mass, that we want to dissolve the federal government. We are demanding first local government and then self-government, and we are going to disintegrate government from the top to the bottom until we restore the rights of the divine individual.
All right, Adam, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Gary.
Times are bad. Call on me, darling, and I'll come to you. distress to find their way in this world. I need you, darling, like the fish need the sea. Don't take your sweet, sweet love from me. Baby, when you're down and feel so blue, well, no, you won't drown, honey. I'll be there too. You're not alone. I'm there too.
And you just heard Janis Joplin do her famous song, Call on Me. See you next week at Great Speeches and Interviews.